Okay, so I think we'd be starting. We'll start recording. This is a presentation and discussion on Trotsky's Revolution Betrayed, Chapter 8, Parts 1 and 2, which is on broadly on the subject of foreign policy and the army. There's two parts. One is world revolution to status quo, and there's one on for the League of Nations and the Communist International, which I think is broadly what we're talking about. We're talking about Stalinism, world revolution, and the League of its attitude to the League of Nations and its sort of default from Bolshevism. So it's pretty obvious that it's about the international implications of Stalinism, and it underlines how profoundly the regime broke with the foundations of Bolshevism in favor of peddling illusory notions that it was able to recruit various imperialist powers and cliques within them to the supposed cause of peace. And I referred to the two parts of the chapter that we're going to talk about today. But early on in these passages, Trotsky quotes a key Bolshevik statement about such perspectives, such illusory perspectives, to underline the gravity of what he was criticizing. And I'll just quote it here. This is Trotsky quoting the program of the Bolshevik Party. And it says that the developing pressure of the proletariat, and especially its victories in individual countries, are strengthening the resistance of the exploiters and impelling them to new forms of international consolidation of the capitalists, i.e. League of Nations, etc., which, organizing on a world scale the systematic exploitation of all the peoples of Earth, are directing their first efforts towards the immediate suppression of the revolutionary movements of the proletariat of all countries. All this inevitably leads to a combination of civil wars within the separate states with revolutionary wars, both of the proletarian countries defending themselves and of the oppressed peoples against the yoke of the imperialist powers. In these conditions, the slogans of pacifism, international disarmament under capitalism, courts of arbitration, etc., are not only reactionary utopias, but downright deceptions of the toilers, designed to disarm the proletariat and distract it from the task of disarming the exploiters. And hello, Emma. Welcome to Emma. Oh, yeah. Just going on
Hi.
from that quotation, the perspective of socialism in one country was right from the start flatly at odds with this. And far from rejecting the slogans, what they said, the slogans of pacifism, international disarmament under capitalism, courts of arbitration, etc., etc., the Communist International under Stalinist leadership became among the chief promoters of these kinds of illusions. But, as Trotsky pointed out, this did not lessen the commitment of the Stalinist leadership to the Comintern. It made them more determined than ever to dominate it. And he explains why. He says that the bureaucracy, however, had no intention to liquidate therewith its connection with the Communist International. That would have converted the latter into a world oppositional organization, with resulting unfavorable consequences in the correlation of forces within the Soviet Union. On the contrary, the less the policy of the Kremlin preserved its former internationalism, the more firmly the ruling clique clutched in its hands the rudder of the Communist International. Under the old name, it was now to serve new ends. For the new ends, however, new people were needed. Beginning with the autumn of 1923, the history of the Communist International is a history of the complete renovation of its Moscow staff and the staffs of all the national sections by way of a series of palace revolutions, purgations from above, expulsions, etc. And he pointed out that if the policies of the Comintern was advocated by 1936 had been enacted earlier, disaster would have befallen the Russian Revolution right from the start. So he said, Soviet power could not have held out for 12 months without the direct help of the international, and especially the European proletariat, and without a revolutionary movement of the colonial peoples. The only reason the Austro-German military powers did not carry their attack upon Soviet Russia through to the end was that they felt behind their back the hot breath of the revolution. In some three quarters of a year, insurrections in Germany and Austro-Hungary put an end to the Brest-Litovsk Treaty. The revolt of the French sailors in the Black Sea in April 1919 compelled the government of the Third Republic to renounce its military operations in the Soviet South. The British government, in September 1919, withdrew its expeditionary forces from the Soviet North under direct pressure from its own workers. And the Soviet government, of course, in the very early days, was compelled to deal with the capitalist powers. But the idea that communist parties should therefore have become partisans of their own government was treasonous. And Trotsky says that, quoting again, he says, it could never have entered the mind of the Soviet government as a whole, however, nor any member of it, to represent its bourgeois counter-agents as friends of peace, and still less to invite the communist parties of Germany, Poland, or Estonia to support with their votes the bourgeois governments that had signed these treaties. And he goes on, he says, though the Rapallo agreement with Democratic Germany was signed 4 years later on a formal basis of equal rights for both parties, nevertheless, if the German Communist Party had made this a pretext to express confidence in the diplomacy of its country, it would have been forthwith expelled from the international. And that's the principle. The policy of the Comintern under Stalin of seeking imperialist allies and chaining the working class movement to alliances with them could only endanger the existence of the workers' state. So Trotsky says this, he says, the danger of a combined attack on the Soviet Union takes palpable form in our eyes only because the country of the Soviets is still isolated, because to a considerable extent this one-sixth of the Earth's surface is a realm of primitive backwardness, because the productivity of labour, in spite of the nationalisation of the means of production, is still far lower than in capitalist countries. And finally, what is at present most important, because the chief detachments of the world proletariat are shattered, distrustful of themselves, and deprived of reliable leadership. And he goes on, he says, the nationally limited and conservative, ignorant and irresponsible Soviet bureaucracy has brought nothing but misfortunes to the workers' movement of the world. As though in historic justice, the present international position of the Soviet Union is determined to a far higher degree by the consequences of the defeat of the world proletariat than by the successes of an isolated socialist construction. It's sufficient to recall that the defeat of the Chinese Revolution of 1925 to 1927, which untied the hands of Japanese militarism in the East, and the shattering of the German proletariat, which led to the triumph of Hitler and the mad growth of German militarism, are alike the fruits of the policy of the Communist International. So, the Stalinist bureaucracy then devoted its political and diplomatic efforts to neutralizing the bourgeoisie, neutralizing in quotes, right? And hence you had the significance of the USSR joining the League of Nations in September 1934. And that was the prelude to its agreement with France, which was the Stalin-Laval Pact of 1935. And Pierre Laval, later became a key figure in the Nazi collaborator regime of Marshal Pétain in Vichy, France, after 1940. It's worth remembering that. This was Stalin's partner in crime in the mid-30s, you know. So Trotsky pointed out that this pact was, quoting again, indefinitely more favourable to France than to the Soviets. The military obligation from the side of the Soviets is, according to the treaty, unconditional. French help, on the contrary, is conditioned upon a preliminary agreement with England and Italy, which opens an unlimited field for hostile machinations against the Soviet Union. But that's what he said. But the USSR's entry into the League of Nations was accompanied by a deluge of propaganda, where trying to portray it as a triumph of socialism and a result of pressure from the world proletariat. Whereas Trotsky says that in reality, it was acceptable to the bourgeoisie only as a result of the extreme weakening of the revolutionary danger. It was not a victory of the Soviet Union, but a capitulation of the Confirmadorian bureaucracy to this hopelessly compromised Geneva institution, which, according to the above-quoted words of the Bolshevik programme, will direct its future efforts to the suppression of revolutionary movements. And that's what the Bolshevik programme said about the League of Nations. So the result is that the USSR had to abide by the rules of the League of Nations. And it did. For instance, over Italy's seizure of Abyssinia. And Trotsky notes that at this very time when Litvinov, who was nothing at Geneva but a shadow of Laval, that's the Soviet foreign minister at the time, I believe, he expressed his gratitude to the diplomats of France and England for their efforts on behalf of peace, efforts which so auspiciously resulted in the annihilation of Abyssinia, oil from the Caucasus continued to nourish the Italian fleet. So Stalin was supplying oil to Mussolini at the time he was invading Abyssinia, you know. And he emphasizes the treachery of this refusal to combat Mussolini. He says, even if you can understand that the Moscow government hesitated openly to break a commercial treaty, still the trade unions were not obliged to take into consideration the undertakings of the Commissariat of Foreign Trade. An actual stoppage of exports to Italy by a decision of the Soviet trade unions would have evoked a world movement of boycotts incomparably more real than the treacherous sanctions measured as they were in advance by diplomatists and jurists in agreement with Mussolini. And he points out also that this collaboration was flatly in contradiction with the policy of the Comintern, even in the days of the British general strike of 1926, which was far from being a perfect Bolshevik policy. But nevertheless, he says, he recalls that if the Soviet trade unions never lifted a finger this time, in contrast with 1926, when they openly collected millions of rubles for the British coal strike, it's only because such an initiative was forbidden by the ruling bureaucracy, chiefly to curry favour with France. In the coming World War, however, no military allies can recompense the Soviet Union for the lost confidence of the colonial peoples and of the toiling masses in general. But then we get, quoted by Trotsky, Stalin's statement in Izvestia from September 1935, where he says, he quotes and he says, Trotsky's quote Stalin saying this. He says, the fundamental aim of German fascism is to isolate the Soviet Union. Well, and what of it? The Soviet Union has today more friends in the world than ever before. And Trotsky points out that this was absolutely fatuous, that he says that the Italian proletariat is in the hands of fascism, the Chinese revolution is shattered, and Japan is playing the boss in China. The German proletariat is so crushed that Hitler's plebiscite encounters no resistance whatsoever. And the proletariat of Austria is bound hand and foot. And in terms of recruiting France, Spain and Britain to the supposed friends of peace, supposedly in opposition to Hitler, Trotsky pointed out the words of Lloyd George, who warned the House of Commons against condemning fascist Germany, which was destined to be the most reliable bulwark against communism in Europe. And Lloyd George said, we shall yet greet her as our friend. And then he quotes the notorious interview of Stalin with an American newspaper baron in 1936 as a prime example of bureaucratic blindness. So Stalin said, quoting again, this is quoting Stalin, he said, "I think that the position of the Friends of Peace is growing stronger. The Friends of Peace can work openly. They rely on the strength of public opinion. They have at their disposal such instruments, for instance, as the League of Nations." And Trotsky comes back on that and he says, well, the bourgeois states do not divide themselves into friends and enemies of peace, especially since peace doesn't, as such, does not exist. Each imperialist country is interested in preserving its peace, and the more sharply interested, the more unbearable this peace may be for its enemies. The formula common to Stalin, Baldwin, Leon Blum and others, that peace would really be guaranteed if all the states united in the League for its defence, merely means that peace would be guaranteed if there existed no causes for its violation. Well, that thought is correct, if you please, but not exactly weighty. And he explains that, that disarmament is a fatuous perspective because, quoting again, he says, the imperialists do not make war because there are armaments. On the contrary, they forge arms when they need to fight. And the possibilities of a new and, moreover, very speedy arming lie in contemporary technique. And that's interesting, actually, that latter point, because the one thing that's modifies that today is the deindustrialization of the imperialist countries, which has somewhat put a spanner in the works of that, as we are seeing today. But that's way into the future. That's not the conditions of 1936. So, in beginning to sum this up, Trotsky writes this. He writes, the Third International was born of an indignant protest against social patriotism, but the revolutionary charge placed in it by the October Revolution is long ago expended. The Communist International now stands under the banner of the League of Nations, as does the Second International, only with a fresher store of cynicism. When the British socialist Sir Stafford Cripps called the League of Nations an international union of brigands, which was more impolite than unjust, the London Times ironically asked, in that case, how do you explain the adherence of the Soviet Union to the League of Nations? And Trotsky notes that that's not easy to answer. Yeah. Now, the truth about that was that the leftward motion of the workers' movement under the impact of the Depression and the threat of fascism meant that people like Cripps himself and people like him had moved to the left of Stalin. And that's the reason for that. You know, Stalin elaborated what he meant a bit more in that same interview with this American press person. And asked him about his plans for world revolution. And Stalin said, he's quoted again, he says, we never had such plans or intentions. This is the result of a misunderstanding. And which Howard, who was interviewing him, asked, a tragic misunderstanding? And Stalin replied, no, comic, or if you please, tragic comic. And then he says, what danger can the surrounding states see in the ideas of the Soviet people if these states sit really firmly in the saddle? The idea of exporting a revolution is nonsense. Every country, if it wants one, will produce its own revolution. And if it doesn't, there will be no revolution. For instance, our country wanted to make a revolution and made it. And then he finishes there. And Trotsky mocks this and scores it. And he points out that this is what Trotsky says. He says, before our country desired to make a revolution, we imported the ideas of Marxism from other countries and made use of foreign revolutionary experience. For decades, we had our emigres abroad who guided the struggle in Russia. We received moral and material aid from the workers' organizations of Europe and America. After our victory, we organized in 1919 the Communist International. We more than once announced the duty of the proletariat of countries in which the revolution had conquered to come to the aid of oppressed and insurrectionary classes, and not only with ideas, but if possible, with arms. And that was not just a theoretical point. It was, you know, it wasn't just a principle. It was a practicality. So he notes that we in our own time aided the workers of Finland, Latvia, Estonia and Georgia with armed force. We made an attempt to bring aid to the revolting proletariat in Poland by the campaign of the Red Army against Warsaw. We sent organisers and commanders to the help of the Chinese in revolution. In 1926, we collected millions of rubles for the aid of the British strikers. At present, this seems to have been a misunderstanding. A tragic one? No, it's comic. And even the Communist International has changed from a serious to a comic personage. So Trotsky laid out at the end, he says, well, this is what Stalin should have said if he were to openly proclaim the truth. And what he should have said is this. In the eyes of Lenin, the League of Nations was a machine for the preparation of a new imperialist war. We see it as an instrument of peace. Lenin spoke of the inevitability of revolutionary wars. We consider the idea of exporting revolution nonsense. Lenin denounced the union of the proletariat with the imperialist bourgeoisie as treason. We, with all our power, impel the international proletariat along this road. Lenin slashed the slogan of disarmament under capitalism as a deceit of the workers. We build our whole policy upon this slogan. Your tragicomic misunderstanding lies in your taking us for the continuers of Bolshevism, when we are in fact its grave diggers. But of course, he could never have actually said that, but that was the truth. I'll leave it there. And I'll open it up to discussion. That concludes my summary of this part. Cheers. So, who wants to speak on this?
Well, since nobody speaks, then I am going to. Yeah?
Yes.
I'm afraid I'm nowhere as well prepared as Ian, but I'll just do my bit. So I'm going to try. So I think that on the whole, this is extremely relevant because we are in front of exactly the same thing today with all the workers' parties and mostly most of the communist parties. Anyway, so to go back to the document, what we have seen in what Ian said, that there have been all sorts of treaties after the revolution, treaties, the Brest-Litovsk Treaty. I'll go in more detail. The Brest-Litovsk Treaty in 1918, Estonia, 1920, Riga, Poland, 1920, and at Rapallo, there was an accord with Germany in 1922. That last thing, this accord of Rapallo, was not signed into a treaty until 4 years later in Berlin. So in 1920, it was just an agreement. Rapallo was a commitment to establish between Germany and Soviet Russia friendly relations and renounce all territorial claims between Russia and Germany, upon which, as we have seen, the Stalin leadership was overjoyed, thinking that now it had friends. That was a lot of diplomacy on the part of the Soviet Union. But it would never occurred to the Soviet government or to any member of that government to qualify these bourgeois people with whom they had made accords, to qualify them as friends of peace. This would never have occurred, as Ian explained the reason why. And still less would it have invited the communist parties. So the Soviet leadership would have never invited the Communist Party of Germany, Poland, Estonia, or others to vote for their bourgeois governments in the elections of those countries. That just wouldn't have happened. But myself, I witnessed when I was young that the French Communist Party voted against immigration, and all these people in the communist, so-called Communist International, which was still, it was no longer alive, but nevertheless it was still functioning as a counter-revolutionary force. They were pleased with what the French had done. But already now, back in May 1922, back to the document, the Soviet Foreign Secretary Chicherin had proposed to the Bolshevik leadership to introduce, he said, certain democratic changes in the Soviet constitution. So you see, it's not long, just a few years after the revolution, somebody in the Soviet leadership wants democratic changes. And for this, Trotsky explains, that was to please some sectors of the public opinion in America, and obviously for the purpose of further agreements. Lenin's leadership slapped this down angrily. This leadership was utterly aware that making accords with these warmongers was only a matter of diplomacy. And Trotsky to say, I quote Trotsky, "This is just this question which is decisive for the revolutionary education of the masses." And I would say, I would suggest here, it is our education, because this is in the end, when we face the CND and stop the war, and the mass of the people, in fact, who are opposed to the genocide of the Palestinians, there is a huge idealization of the West, in spite of their comprehension that it is a warmonger, and it is therefore up to us to retake every aspect of this debate to apply it today. So I just want to make another point. The insurrections in Germany and Austro-Hungary had made it impossible for Germany to put the Soviets on their knees after Brest-Litovsk. And this is why, after Brest-Litovsk, there was not further intervention from the West to actually continue the defeat of the Soviet Union, because there were insurrections, all the revolts. And so apart from what Ian mentioned, which is very important, about the world revolution blowing in the neck of the imperialists, there were also the revolts. So this is in more details. The revolts by the sailors, the dockers, the workers of the British, French and US imperialists that had sailed to support the white armies over there towards the Bolsheviks in the young Soviet Union. They wanted to finish it off and to crush it to support the whites. In 1923, Lord Curzon delivered an arrogant ultimatum to Moscow, but Curzon found his hands bound by the resistance of the British Workers' Organization. The Communist Party had been formed in Britain in 1920. That was just 3 years ago. And the general strike was only 3 years away. So the imperialists were not in a position to continue their attack on the Soviet Union. But the Soviet bureaucracy, when they got rid of Leninism and Marxism, they thought it was because they were so great, because the world was afraid of them, because they were unassailable, because they were them, and other aspects of arrogance. And this was an idealization of what had happened. They had not seen. It was a contempt for the masses and the working class, because they had not seen and had not wanted to see that it had been the British, the Germans, the Estonians, the American workers who actually defeated them, the imperialists, and stopped them from going further against the worker state. And because of that degeneration in the Soviet leadership, there was also contempt for the working class. And this is why But the Soviet trade union didn't mean anything for Stalin. The party stopped functioning, and the trade unions were cast aside, and at the leadership of the trade unions were put people that we have in Britain, and people who were connive with the West, and so they were manacled. They could not intervene when they could have done independently of the Soviet leadership. So what the Soviet leadership of Stalin did was to make sure the workers could not be independent, could not have a class independence from the leadership. I think this is an explanation of what happened with the trade unions. They had in 1926 collected money in Soviet Union for the British workers, but they could no longer do it later on because the bureaucracy had manacled them. So I know this is there's much more to be said, but I would like to go to the conclusion. So the naivety, this is the way I say it, it is not in the text. This naivety of the Soviet leadership was interested, self-interested. It meant to stop the revolution extending elsewhere in the world, a process that would force the USSR to go in solidarity, expand the program of expropriation of feudal and capitalists that would have entailed supporting revolutions and wars. The Soviet leaders, like Stalin and his clique, no longer left in peace and quiet. For their own self-advancement. All that, of course, they were absolutely determined not to have. And so this foreign policy of Stalin, it's interesting how the text starts with saying that foreign policy and internal policy cannot forever remain different. I think we should go back to that at another time. The policy of socialism in one country on a world scale as an international policy had its equivalent internally into making sure that the revolution should not extend, that Marxism should not be discussed anymore, and that the working class should be made dependent on the bureaucracy. So this naivety, self-interested, made the Soviet leadership blind to the fact that the safety even of the state upon which they depended on the worker state, and indeed the continuation of the worker state depended on the growth of world revolution, which I think is key again to us in our own education, to say, well, I will have socialism just here and we don't need anything in the world, is in fact self-defeating and leads to defeat. The question of this, the alignment with the Soviet, with the historic enemy, the alignment of the bureaucracy with the historic enemy of capitalism has never been so apposite as it is today. It is, like Trotsky say, just this question which is decisive for the revolutionary education of the masses and for our own. Yeah. I'll finish here.
Okay, come on.
I've got pages more.
Sure. Who else wants to speak? Anybody? Diana wants to speak.
Yeah, there was
then
just
John.
One. Sorry. There was just Diana, one.
Then John, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah. There was just one small point that I don't know whether it is all that small, that Trotsky made about the League of Nations, which seems to me to apply exactly to the UN today, saying that it's the defense of the status quo, not an organization of peace, but violence of the imperialist minority over the majority of mankind. And that's stood out for me because that exactly describes the UN as it is now. As far, you know, maybe I'm being jaded about it. I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Sure. John.
Yeah, I mean, Maria seemed to be implying that it was the actions of the working class, largely in the West, that stopped the Soviet Union from being attacked, if I understood it right. Now, I'm not as familiar with the history of all this, but I don't think that was really the case. I don't think it was that the Soviet Union did get huge solidarity from various other working classes especially in the West, especially in the United States and places like Britain. I mean, the British Communist Party was, as I understand, very small, and to think that it had some influence on stopping the if I understood it right, on stopping on making the imperialists back down from their attacks on the Soviet Union. Maybe to a small extent, but I can't think that was a huge factor. But I'm not that as familiar with the history. But I mean, the solidarity with this with the Soviet Union, I mean, was quite, it was quite patchy. As far as I understand it, but then my reading of the history is very limited. Anyway.
Just on that, I think you're wrong, actually. I think there were incidents in British history. It really wasn't the Soviet Union as such. It was Soviet Russia in the until 1922. But in the very early days of the Russian Revolution, there were major conflicts with the working class in Britain, actually. There was an incident of what was called the Jolly George, which was a ship that was covertly sending arms to Poland to Pilsudski's regime for use against Russia. And that the uncovering of that ship, of what and it was actually a munition ship doing that, provoked a strike. And then the TUC was under such pressure, it was pressure towards calling a general strike over the question of British intervention in against the Russian Revolution. I think that was in 1920. I remember when I was in the Sparts, we had an article on the Jolly George and how important it was, and I do think it was important, actually. Though, I mean, they quoted other, Trotsky quotes other incidents in France. He doesn't actually quote that one, though it may be what he was alluding to in his remarks about the British sort of being thwarted by the pressure from the working class. But I think it's very clear that the Brest-Litovsk situation the Brest-Litovsk Treaty was effectively negated when Germany and Austria-Hungary effectively collapsed, and it collapsed in the face of defeat and of a working class upsurge. Which led, of course, to the Spartacus uprising of 1919, ultimately, which of course was defeated. I mean, there's no doubt about that it was defeated, but it was a major revolutionary outburst nevertheless, and it laid the basis for other sort of conflicts with the German working class going on as far as 1923. I do, that was the most serious attack on Soviet Russia was the Brest-Litovsk Treaty. It was the concessions that were forced on them. They had to give up most of Ukraine. They had to give up a whole lot of other parts of the west of what was the Russian Empire, right? Which had been, of course, had been, a locus of the revolution, right? And that had to be just conceded to German militarism. When they decided to when the Bolsheviks bailed out of the war, which of course was their program, to stop Russia's involvement in the war. You know, but they had to make concessions to get that agreement signed. And we know for a fact that Trotsky didn't want to sign the agreement. And he, there were others who were more hostile to signing it than he was. But in the end, he first of all had a position of neither peace nor war, and of signing, you know, not signing the agreement, but not walking away either, you know. And Lenin actually basically insisted that the Bolsheviks had to sign that agreement. But they knew very well that Germany was on the brink, you know, that Germany was failing, and it would be something that would not last long. And it turned out to be the case. They conquered back all those territories in a matter of months when Germany did collapse, you know. And they had confidence that the German working class would actually cause sufficient problems to the German bourgeoisie in the context of them losing the war that they wouldn't be able to do anything about it. Now, the question of the Allies, the other side of the Entente, the other side of the war, is obviously more complicated. And I agree there wasn't much happened in the United States. Although it wasn't entirely devoid of the American ruling class was frightened of communism, even though it was not much affected by it in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution. You saw the Palmer raids, right? The attacks on migrant workers who had communist connections, hysterical stuff, as crazy as anything you see today, you know, about immigration and the threat of communism. That's what it was all about in those days, the Palmer raids, you know. So there was actually some response in the United States. But I think the British workers' movement was polarized by the Russian Revolution. There was an element of solid... It was more radical, I think, at that point than in its whole history, because there was an element of solidarity with the Irish struggle as well at the same time, you know, in that period immediately after the collapse after the end of World War One, you know, that did exist. There was a real resonance for support for Irish independence, which, of course, you know, the Irish did gain independence after the First World War. Albeit with a civil war that was forced on them by the British as well. But there was that element of support for Irish independence, and there was support for Soviet Russia. The Jolly George incident, I think, really does crystallise that. It's probably worth doing something more on that. There is an old article in Workers' Hammer on it, which I will have to dig out, or even Spartacist Britain, I can't remember. It goes back to the early 80s, you know. Possibly during the miners' strike, actually. But yeah, I think there's more to it than you think. You know, sorry, John wants to come back.
I mean, I'm not as familiar with the history. It's a long time since I've looked at it. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, you know, there was a good article in Fight Racism, Fight Imperialism about this period and the attitude of the British labour movement to the Irish independence.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the article was saying, well, you know, if you can equate high workers' struggle with politicisation, they said, why didn't the British labour movement move this and that on the Irish? Well, I can't remember the article, but it made a point, look, it doesn't translate. That just because there's struggle within the British working class, that will translate into political, you know, like I think it was probably an attack on the SWP, but that will translate to political demands and political consciousness. It's not, one doesn't flow from the other. And I have to take your word for it, but I haven't studied the period and I don't know. But, just the whole thing of the British Labour Party. Why then didn't, you know, in that period, if things were so, if the working class was moving in that direction, why didn't the British Labour Party move in a leftward direction,
uh-huh.
which it didn't, you know, and one looks very hard at the US for solidarity over anything historically.
Yeah.
And as soon as, you know, and things like that. And, you know, it just doesn't follow for me anyway, but.
Sure.
I'll let other people have their word.
Paul.
In terms of why didn't the Labour Party go in the more leftward direction, perhaps this is it's a very simplistic way of looking at it, but it's alluded to in the text when obviously Kroc is talking about the Soviet bureaucracy, but in that Soviet bureaucracy, he also talks about the trade union bureaucracy. Well, we had that same, we've always had that same problem here. And of course, well, we have. Trade union bureaucracy might have made some very left-wing speakers here and there, but when it came to the push, they've always been quite bourgeoisie in practice. And of course, the trade union bureaucracy in the very early days of the Labour Party was actually quite reactionary. And I think it, to a large extent, in fact, I don't know about that particular period, but if you go to the run-up to the 1945 Labour government and some of the individuals involved in the trade union bureaucracy in the run-up to that period, they were very anti-communist and so on. So I don't think we could underplay the role of the British trade union bureaucracy. Even at that period, the trade union bureaucracy was extremely right-wing. And so to answer your question, why didn't the Labour Party move more to the left if there was that worker struggle? Well, that's part of my answer. Thanks.
Can I come back on this? I mean, I think the Labour Party actually was a very, very elemental organisation at the time of the First World War. It didn't even have individual membership until 1918. And in 1918, it did actually consolidate itself as an individual members' party around Clause 4 of its constitution as it was constituted, written by the Webbs, right, which had the original formulation, which was to secure for the workers the by hand or by brain, the what's it called, the social ownership of the means of production and blah, 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 blah. The stuff that Tony Blair abolished in 1995 was actually put in place by the Webbs as a response to the Russian Revolution, actually, you know. So it's not true that the Labour Party was not affected by the Russian Revolution. It was profoundly affected, but it was at a very low level because the British working class was in the most, what was then the, just about the imperialist hegemon, you know. It was coming, its period was coming to an end, and in some ways had been massively shaken by the war. But it hadn't been completely lost its power in the world. That didn't really happen until the Second World War. You know, it became contested between the wars. But actually, Britain was the most powerful imperialist country still at the end of the war. You know, although it did have to be bailed out by the United States through the Dawes Plan and whatever. But the United States was up and coming. But the United States was not fully engaged with Europe at that point. It was sort of somewhat aloof. And it was probably wealthier even then than the European imperialist countries, which is probably why it was relatively unaffected by the Russian Revolution compared to Europe. But yeah, I mean, there were impacts on the working class. I think the RCG has a particular bias, which is the opposite of the SWP, and they're probably both wrong, actually, because the SWP tails after existing trade union consciousness and glorifies it and makes it out to be revolutionary, whereas the RCG has a third world sort of a belief, a lack of belief in the revolutionary capacity of the working class. And that's part of their ideology. It's part of a third world Stalinist ideology, which I think is, I mean, they are a third world Stalinoid organization, aren't they? You know, and they've always had this position that's a little bit Maoist, that thinks the working class of the imperialist countries is privileged, which of course there is a labor, there is no doubt there is a strong labor aristocracy, but it seems to draw that to a higher level. And, you know, it has a very sort of a pessimistic, excessively pessimistic view of the capacity of the working class in those countries to do anything, really. That's my opinion of the RCG. You know, they have this element of moralism, and they tail after the consciousness of sort of bourgeois nationalists in other countries, like their absolute enthusiasm for the ANC, for instance, to the point of Mandela songs all the time. And all this, you know, they were excessively enthusiastic about forms of nationalism in the third world, but had a jaundiced view of the potential, revolutionary potential of the working class in the imperialist countries. That's part of their politics, you know. So, I mean, I'm sure they will write things that are correct, that are accurate, but I think their overall perspective is wrong, you know. And yeah, the Labour Party did move to the left over the period after 1917. The evidence of it is clause four. That's one piece of big evidence. The other thing, of course, is that there were revolts against, perhaps on a not a sufficient level, but there was hostility to the intervention in Ireland. And if there hadn't been, actually, the Irish would have got crucified, because Britain had the military power to wipe out the Irish struggle, but they didn't. They weren't able to do that because it would have caused too much problems in Britain. They had to seek a compromise, albeit it was a forced compromise. You know, it led to the Irish Civil War and things like that. But it's not true there was no radicalization, no serious unease in the working class movements. And of course, if you look at what happened in the years afterwards, you had the formation of the Anglo-Russian Trade Union Committee. You know, the years after, you know, this became a vehicle for Stalinist misdeeds and rotten combinations with left wing trade union bureaucrats and the likes of Purcell and Hicks and A.J. Cook. But A.J. Cook was a very serious left wing bureaucrat. And he was equivalent to, you know, he was more powerful than Arthur Scargill, because the miners were much bigger and more powerful than they were in the days of Arthur Scargill. There were a million of them or more, you know, in the period up, you know, in those days, because Britain was built on coal, you know. The Industrial Revolution and British industrial might was built on coal. And the miners were enormously powerful. And A.J. Cook was the leader of the miners' union, and he was a strong pro-Russian bureaucrat. He was not a revolutionary, but he was similar to Arthur Scargill, and he was a linchpin of the British. He was a sympathiser of the British Communist Party. He was a central figure in what became the Anglo-Russian Committee, you know, which of course was used by Stalin to. This is the allusion that, you know, Trotsky's point about the Russian trade unions raising money for the British miners and the British general strike, you know, there is truth in that, because it gave a left cover to the TUC, and it ended up with the raising the slogan "All power to the General Council" instead of "All power to the Soviets," you know, and the General Council was the people who betrayed the general strike, of course, you know, who sent people back to work, you know, so it was a rather strange idea actually, but nevertheless, you know, that the existence of the Anglo-Russian Committee speaks to the fact there was a pro-communist current. It wasn't a mass communist party. It wasn't like in France or in Italy or Spain or whatever, but it was a significant layer. But Britain was a wealthier country than those countries, you know. Britain was more privileged historically than some of the other countries where the communist parties grew much bigger. You know, so you know, I think it's over-egging it to say there's nothing happening in the working class as a result of the Russian Revolution, or even about the Irish question. It wasn't as strong as it should have been, that's the truth, because Britain was a privileged country. But it's not true that nothing happened. Things did happen. They were on a lower level, though. That's my view, anyway. Sorry. Who else wants to speak? Marie.
Only if I don't want to keep Emily or the other comrades out of turn.
Oh, there's plenty of time, I think. Yeah. If anybody else wants to speak, there's plenty of time for discussion.
Okay. So I'll just bring up what I wanted to say. At the end, this replacement in the Soviet Union of a Bolshevik leadership which understood what capitalism and imperialism is about. It understood that that is war. The replacement of that leadership by a bureaucracy which idealizes them, which makes agreements, and in many ways is stimulated by the fact that there was a pro-Soviet influence, like you just said, Ian, in the trade unions. In Britain, there wouldn't have been any Anglo-Russian committee or Anglo-French committee, by the way, if it had been that there was all this sympathy. And so the Soviet bureaucracy was trying to utilize this, order to neutralize the bourgeoisie. And I find that not naive. It is a naivety, if that's the way to say it. But it's an interested one in order to keep their position as bureaucrats. It was to strengthen the bureaucracy, the place of the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union by looking at these people in support and changing those structures. And I think it contains this naivety, which is interested. It contains also an element of misconception, which is a conception which is not Marxist, or that you can make a friend, you can tell imperialism, you take your part of the world and we will have this other part. And I think even Putin has had this notion when he was talking about my colleague, about the Western leaders. He was calling them his colleagues. Yeah. Until very recently, which is a concept which comes from the abandonment of Marxism to say, oh, well, we have this system here, you have your system over there, and then we can get along together. And this is a negation of the class struggle. It cannot happen that way because the wealth which is accumulated by imperialism is taken, is robbed from the rest of the world.
That's
so,
right.
Emily, is that you?
Yes, sorry.
I would want you to say a bit more about that, eh? But then I want to finish that, just finish that little aspect of the thing. And so the guarantee for the continuation of the Soviet Union was in the interest of Stalin, because he needed the Soviet Union to continue in order for him to be the great man. But the thing is, what he was doing was eventually emasculating it, and then the communist parties developed leaderships, like I said, about the French one, which became anti-immigration in the 70s, and then all sorts of crimes, like they didn't want Greece and I think it's Ireland to enter the European common market. Why? That was a position of big imperialists. And well, the Communist Party doesn't want everybody in the common market. It had nothing to do with the Communist Party. That was an abandonment of Marxism completely. And then, of course, the result was the implosion, or whatever you call it, of the Soviet Union. Finally, this had to happen. If that was not corrected, if it wasn't corrected, then it was going to fail. And fail it did. And I propose that we look at that aspect again in due course.
Sure.
Yeah, Emily, you wanted to say.
Hey. You want to say something? Emma?
No, I've just said that's right. That's all.
Right.
Oh, you could expand.
If you want to.
No.
Just, I mean, yeah, the one thing I did disagree with you slightly about Marie is about them being naive. I think that might have been true earlier. In the, you know, Stalin was not naive. Stalin was pretty hard-bitten opponent of Bolshevism and communism by then. He was so naive, he had rounded up all the Trotskyists and would like to have had them shot. And in fact, in many cases, he did, you know, and not just Trotskyists. I mean, Zinoviev, Kamenev, Bukharin, they were all executed by Stalin. They were not really naive. They were hardened bureaucrats of a particularly brutal kind by then. They'd become a counter-revolutionary caste, you know. Not all Stalinist bureaucrats were like Stalin, you know. They were not all as hardened and cynical as that, you know. There is variety, but Stalin's regime was certainly not naive. Though it's possibly, yeah, you could argue it was earlier, in its earlier evolution. You know, in the 20s, the Anglo-Soviet Committee, the Anglo-Russian Committee, some of the stuff they did in China was centrist. It wasn't yet at that point. It was not. It had not gone over decisively to the other side of the barricades. Socialism in one country is an anti-Marxist idea, but they hadn't consolidated themselves on that until after Hitler's victory, really. You know, that was the decisive point where they were faced with the ultimate consequences of their policy, and they either had to decide whether to renounce it or to carry on and double down and carry on and continue with it. And they did just that, you know. And they were aware of how dangerous and of how much blood they put in between themselves and the Bolshevik tradition by that point, you know. And Stalin actually draw the logic of that, which is to kill as many of his opponents as possible, in his political left-wing opponents. Even people who were technically to his right, like Bukharin, were considered to be potentially dangerous people who could learn and change their minds and become a dangerous left-wing opponent at some point. So they had them shot, you know. They were not, strictly speaking, part of Stalin's bureaucratic regime, so they had them all shot. Even the ones who were technically to the right, because they could have become a left-wing danger, you know, because they were still thinking Marxists in some sense, you know. So they had to be shot, basically. They were not naive. They were a hardened counter-revolutionary caste by then, but certainly in their earlier period, they did have a there was centrism about them. Yeah, that's a stage in their evolution, you know. In the 20s, Stalinism was centrist. In the 30s, by the mid-30s, it was counter-revolutionary in a definitive sense, you know. Not in the social sense, obviously, because that's a different question, but in its political sense, you know. Sorry, Mark wants to speak.
It's only a simple question, really. It's taken me a while to work out what level Stalin is, bad scale. I'm just wondering why so many communists support Stalin. What's the reason for that?
I think there are lots
That's
of reasons. There are lots of reasons. He wasn't definitively discredited among great many subjective communists because he died. He died in office. He was, you know, he gained, although he was not very good, and in fact he made huge errors of judgment that laid the basis for Hitler's attack on the USSR. In the end, Stalin was at the head of the Soviet regime that defeated Hitler. So therefore, he gained some prestige from that among the communists who often were naive, actually. Many of them are naive. The rank and file followers in the wider world, many of them are naive. And they can be, you know, sort of bamboozled and brainwashed by a movement that appears to have some prestige and appears to have some achievements. And of course, defeating Hitler was an achievement. I mean, it was exp it, it, you can explain by going into depth, it happened despite Stalin, not because of him. But nevertheless, that doesn't really, that's quite a subtle point. And to many rank and file communists throughout the world, it was too difficult, too subtle. So they just throw Stalin defeated Hitler. That is the so Stalin gained great prestige, you know. And I think Stalinophobia is a real problem in the left. You know, the left can't deal. You know, there are elements of the Trotskyist left who lost their nerve politically and can't deal with this problem, you know, and became Stalinophobic, became third campist, you know. And that was a serious mistake as well. The other mistake, the flip side of Stalinism, you know, is that people who abandoned the defense of the Soviet Union and became, you know, Stalinophobes, which I think is, you know, he's an equal, you know, manifestation of being wrong to being a Stalinist in itself, if not worse, you know. But yeah, it's not so simple because of the concrete way things worked out. And the Trotskyist movement disintegrated after the Second World War. Trotsky was murdered, and his intellect was no longer available to the movement. And people got themselves into all sorts of mutually contradictory muddles. You know, you could say complementary errors. You know, there were plenty of people were wrong in different ways. A bit like the RCG and the and this SWP I was talking about, they're both wrong in some ways. They both make symmetrically obvious, symmetrically opposite errors on that subject, and nobody's got the correct position. And that's the sort of things that happened. Or the people who did were quite sort of minor, you know, like the Sparts over Cuba. They were right over Cuba. They were bloody wrong over Zionism, though, you know. And there's been a lack of coherence and a lack of a coherent Marxist pole since the Second World War, because after the death of Trotsky. So, you know, you can see why Stalinism retained a lot of its prestige. And there are still people today who are very dedicated communists who we work with, like the NCP comrades, who, well, some of them, anyway. No, they are. They are. I mean, despite their problems, they are. You know, they're very dedicated communists, but they're wrong. You know, wrong in different ways, but they're wrong. You know, but they're still dedicated communists, objectively. And we have to try and sort that out politically. You know, Paul.
Yeah, on that point, actually, maybe there isn't a simple answer, but I realised as we were discussing this, how would a Stalinist today respond to some of Trotsky's criticism? I don't think, so that's my question. If you want to answer that, the other comment I was going to make is when you talk about the Trotskyist movement basically dissipating after the war and splitting into various different groups, I think even in America there was a big Trotskyist current in the 1960s, wasn't there? Anyway, those are my questions, really. Thanks.
Sure. Well, just on, welcome to Max, who's just arrived, by the way. I had to mute his microphone because it's. There's some background noise immediately drowned everybody else out. But, the history of this is very complex. And yes, there were large Trotskyist movements in the 60s, and not just in the United States, but in Europe. But some of them were very flawed. We should probably do some educationals on these questions. What was the United Secretariat of the Fourth International? What was Pabloism? You know, what was all these things? You know, you know, all these things need to be need to be, we need to have educationals on all these actually. So there's a resource that people can actually, that's why we tape these things as well, because it's a resource that people can go and listen to, and I think we do need these educationals. And I'm gonna, I think we'll probably try to do some of these things in future, and discuss some of the questions involving what was the USFI, what was Pabloism, what is the politics of the SWP, the politics of Tony Cliff, the politics of various other major currents. That's very important to discuss, I think, and it's a lot of work. It's a hell of a lot of work, but it will have to be done. What was, I can't remember what your original question was, Paul, but I think it was something to do with Stalinism and
Yeah, my question is generally, how would a Stalinist,
see,
I mean, they're not just one group, I know, but in general, how would a Stalinist today respond to some of the criticisms that we've been talking about in the text?
I don't know. I mean, I think there'd be a variety of different responses. I think the closed mind syndrome is not as severe as it was. And there are people who are very anti-Trotskyists who may actually think about this. I mean, even the people like the Stalin Society and the CPGBML, they tried, when we endorsed their initiative, their world anti-imperialist platform, they refused to print our stuff on it. But they haven't completely bawled everybody out, and they have maintained some low-level dialogue with us. And how, why do these Trotskyists want to endorse our anti-imperialist statement? Because it's not a bad statement, that's why. And I think there are room. I mean, the NCP. You talk to Andy Brooks, and you'll find he's almost a Trotskyist. In terms of his understanding of quite a few things, but he's the general secretary of the New Communist Party, which is a hardline pro. He's not the original general secretary. That was what's his name, Eric French. But he's the general secretary of the New Communist Party. It's a hardline pro-Moscow split from the old British CP, So, but he's almost a Trotskyist. He understands that the Soviet bureaucracy on some level was a Labour bureaucracy, there are other people who are quite respectful of us today, like Dermot, who's a hardline supporter of Kim Jong-il, Kim Il-sung, ultimately, the politics of Kim Il-sung and his son and his grandson, but we have a fraternal sort of, he sometimes buys our paper now, I think there's room for this to, for collaboration and discussion. It's a pity we are so small, but we are doing it as much as we can, and long may it continue, and hopefully we'll be able to make progress with it, So I don't think there's a monolithic hostility to us. I think there's a because we are seen as very pro-Russian, and we do take sides with Russia in this conflict. I think that it actually does stand. People like us and the Bolshevik tendency, and there are other people who are hardline Russia defences, Soviet defences, Trotskyists of various types. There's room for dialogue with Stalinists, and I think it's happening slowly, Sorry, John, you want to come in?
Yeah, no, it's just that the I mean, what Stalin has said, I mean, Stalinism has been on the decline for a long time, and it will continue that decline. It will become hybrid or something. And so what would they say? Well, they're like the rest of us, they're in perpetual change, aren't they? They're changing their politics, and they're changing their views of what Stalinism was, and that's an ongoing process.
Who else wants to speak? The problem is, I see that some people are writing stuff in the chat, but my eyesight is not very good actually at the moment. I'm just waiting for my new pair of spectacles to arrive. So it's sort of a
Oh, sorry.
That's all right, no problem.
I'd just put in a note to say that one of the important things for us now is to expose neocolonialism and its role and the evolution of imperialism now into US hegemony. In other words, that things like the French and the British Empire, although they are falling and people generally think of them as dead and gone, yes, our involvement in neocolonialism, particularly in Africa and South America, the interference in elections in Africa and South America, mean that we've really morphed ourselves into now we just support US hegemony. But that's where that's where our empire, our imperialism still lies, because that's what the ruling class support. And they don't see any differentiation for it, because the billionaires who are globalists, they just globetrot with their money wherever they like. They don't really, you look at how many of them are multiple passport holders. There is no nationalism anymore. It's an international ruling class of this Western empire. But really, it's a US empire, because it's really directed from Washington with the CIA and FBI, isn't it? You know, that, and you can see it in the way in which America now regards itself as free to arrest anyone, steal anything. You know, look at Maduro's planes being just simply summarily stolen. Why? Well, because we sanctioned him, and he and this man has not taken any notice of our sanctions, so we're just going to steal his property, you know. And Britain comes along, steals Venezuela's gold. It doesn't matter about international courts unless they happen to already be owned by us, like the ICC. It's about the continual fight to get our, you know, the hegemon's will. And, you know, you can see it right down to Hillary Clinton's obsession with trying to push Russiagate. Yes, it doesn't matter how many times the lie is exposed as being a complete nonsense. They still act like it's real, and therefore it has to be obeyed. Yeah, sorry. Thank you, Paul.
I agree with some of what she said there, but that essay we were, well, on the thing about millionaires, they don't have nationalism. Yes and no to a point. I mean, I know that often big businesses, or some not so big, often have foreign companies set up in other countries just so that they can avoid the tax. It's not illegal, it's just a technique that they use to actually get away with paying less tax. So in one level you could argue that they're not nationalist in a sense. But then I'm coming back to that essay that we recently read. I can't remember the guy's name.
Joseph Seymour.
Seymour, who says that, if I remember rightly, he says that there will always be an element of nationalism, even by elements of the bourgeoisie, and any sort of cooperation appears to be temporary. So I'm sort of caught between two arguments, really, because I know that certain business people do actually have their finances set up in such a way that they do actually have operations in other countries precisely to offset the amount of tax they have to pay. But I also take on board what Seymour said in his essay. So, yeah. I'm still open-minded about that particular question.
Just coming the question of globalism. I mean, I think I mean, for instance, this thing about Russiagate, I've always had the view that Russiagate is a fraud, but not for the reasons that many people think it's a fraud. It's not. It's actually transference, because Trump is a foreign agent, but he's not an agent of Russia. He's an agent of bloody Israel. But they don't bloody dare say so, because it's anti-Semitism, supposedly, you know. Trump is funded by Likud, and he has been in three presidential elections, none of which he's actually won, you know. He's always been funded by Likud. He was the man who moved the American embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, you know. And, you know, even though that law was passed mandating that to be done under Clinton in 1995, no one ever implemented it until Trump. And he was basically, one of his main purposes in becoming president was to do things like that and a number of other things connected with the Middle East question, including the Muslim ban and other, you know, chauvinist Islamophobic policies, which dovetail very well with Zionism, you know. And I've always thought that Trump was an Israeli agent. They don't dare not call him an Israeli agent, so it became a surrogate, you know, because he was so pro-Israel that he would do things that no other president would do, like the embassy move, you know. And I think that's really what's behind this, I think, you know. Just as regards I mean, Seymour's essay, the question of is the bourgeoisie a national class? Well, you have this world hegemon, which is now declining. And to a certain extent, the imperialist bourgeoisie was subordinate and is subordinate in Europe to the Americans just by sheer power of American imperialism. American imperialism is losing its power. And you see different currents arising. I mean, even Trump is a nationalist in one level, because his position is Israel first, not really America first, but Israel first is seen as a sort of surrogate for America first. You know, it's still fuck the Europeans, isn't it? You know, there's an element of that about it, anti-European nationalism, as opposed to any other form of nationalism. So his American nationalism is directed against the Europeans and against the peoples of the third world, but he's subservient to Israel. It's a contradictory situation. There's a block between extreme Zionism and this particular form of nationalism. But you see, there are nationalist movements arising in Europe as a response to what Susan is talking about. Global capital is producing its nemesis, which is, for instance, it's the AfD in Germany. It's the rise of Le Pen in France. You know, these people, they have a degree of bourgeois support. They're not simply populist movements. They have a degree of bourgeois support. And Farage is another example. You know, Brexit. What was Brexit? Brexit is I don't think that Brexit was in the was really very rational from the point of view of British capitalism. In fact, it's pushed British capitalism down, hasn't it? You know, Britain is in a you know, Britain is weaker, but economically and in terms of its world role because of Brexit. There's no doubt about that. But a wing of the ruling class went for it anyway. You know, because it's endemic nationalism. It's an inability to get over the nation state. So whenever there's this globalist thing, there's a pushback against it from another wing of the ruling class. You know, even in a contradictory way. So you get an American isolationist nationalist who's also pro-Zionist in America. And not more than one, actually, because you've also got bloody RFK, who had similar views, you know. But he came from the Democrats, you know. I know he's dropped out now, and he's a weird guy anyway. But another reflection of the same phenomenon, you know. So they tear themselves to pieces over this. They're not just a uniformly globalist, are they? You know, it's a mess. Sorry, Paul wants to speak.
Just two small points. I thought it was quite funny the other day about RFK, because he apparently, allegedly, been trying to fight to get off the ballot in places where he was trying to fight to get on the ballot in the first place. Mm. So that tickled me. The other thing about Trump, well, one, even after all this time, I'm still puzzled by even some on the left that acted with Trump with some form of alternative. And I don't know what they're sniffing. And the other thing about Trump is he's also anti-Chinese as well, because if you remember, when he was the president, he tried to trigger a trade war by putting tariffs on their steel. But yes, it really puzzles me. Personally, I don't think we should back either candidates, and I don't think the consistent Democrats do. My personal opinion is to back Cornel West, but he's only likely to get on the ballot in some places. Mm. But in fact, if he was in any danger of gaining any traction, his life would be under threat because of his platform. Thanks.
Well, just on that, I think our position on the presidential election is we support the PSL, the Party of Socialism and Liberation, who are a left-wing ex-Marxite faction who are running for president and vice president. They're running a full ticket. Now, they probably won't get on the ballot in a lot of places either, but they are not a bourgeois candidacy. They are a left-wing presidential campaign, and we do support that critically, of course, because they are a bit liberal at times in some ways. But nevertheless, they are running as a socialist candidacy, and they're pro-Russian and they're anti-Zionist, and very strongly so. So I think we would support them. We wouldn't support RFK or Cornel West or any of them, because they're not socialist, really, are they? None of them are. They're all forms of basically, you know, liberal politics or not so liberal politics. Yeah, but they're still forms of bourgeois politics, whereas the PSL is formally socialist. You know. That's our position. This is position of the Spartacist League as well, that they're supporting the PSL, which is a very, very welcome development from them, who wouldn't have dreamed of supporting something like that, you know, years ago, but they do now, and it's good. You know, I think that's our position as well. You know, it's a position of class conscious, and it's the position of the LCFI. You know. Anyway, yeah. Who else wants to speak?
I would like to come back to something. To go back to the question of the League of Nations and the United Nations, I think it was Diana raised it, and all these you know, peace and disarmament and disarmament conferences, and there's any number of all these things. It is important, it seems to me, to go back to what Trotsky explains, that all these things in capitalism are a deceit. They are meant to deceive the working class and to give the impression that somehow if you wait long enough, some agreement can be reached and there would be no clash between the two. And that a clash would be such a catastrophe, you know, where in fact this is a necessity. By definition, we have to defeat and disarm capitalism. And so there is going to be a clash. And it's not going to be the end of everybody. It's going to be the end of the imperialists, that's what. This is the way I see it. And well, it seems to me one has to talk like this the pacifists, you know, the movement for the ceasefire in Palestine is impregnated with this pacifism. And there is an aspect of this which has to be argued, not in opposition to the comrades, but with argument to show them the need to surpass the question of the ceasefire, because it is now no longer a question of Israel. It's a question of the world matter, which has to be resolved on a world basis, and there's a need for an international.
Absolutely. Who else wants to speak?
I was really pleased, and it's a completely different motion, but I know you were there. I was really pleased hearing on the Crispin Flintoff show this morning that the shouts for people in Gaza is now for end the occupation, not ceasefire now.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a huge move forward, the realization that it's the occupation that is it's like the handing out of polio vaccines, you know, months after the first cases of polio were reported, and the cynical, well, isn't it nice you're going to vaccinate them today so you can bomb them tomorrow with a clear conscience, you know?
Yeah.
We want peace, but we may have to get it through sufficient self-defense, not necessarily to go to war, because we want an end to imperialist wars. But that doesn't mean that we won't fight in our own defense.
That's right. We'll fight to disarm imperialism.
Yeah.
Mark.
I'm struggling to see what the difference is between Trump and the others, to be fair. I mean, Obama was a bit of a butcher, wasn't he? But to be fair, I think the only difference is that Trump doesn't engage his brain with his mouth. But apart from that, I just can't see very much difference between him and the other. Everybody is all a part of the establishment in America, in government. I mean, we've got the odd person in our parliament that's probably a little bit outside of that, but they all are. They all go for the same thing. And it's just that Trump is more stupid. I don't know what everybody else thinks. That's it anyway.
Well, I think Trump has been exposed as being a bit senile now, because he's facing a younger opponent. He was actually having, because he's got his opponent was overtly senile and didn't know that what day of the week it was for a year or two. I think he got away with murder, but now he's got a much younger opponent. He's actually fucked. That's my suspicion, you know.
He doesn't know what to do with women, does he?
No, he doesn't. That's true. Well, I know what he's doing with women, but
no, he doesn't know what to do with strong women.
No. Listen. Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Max. Oh, you want to say something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you mostly agree, but not really that much. I mean, it's relative to the system of to the election coming up. You know, I'm not excited about it, but I used to have a thing where, yeah, I'm a socialist, but sometimes you vote anyway for the lesser evil. Okay, what I'm trying to say is the lesser evil has flipped. I actually think that the Republicans are better than the Democrats now, not because they're Marxists, but because of what's going on with all these people getting arrested and the attack on free speech and all these laws. Well, you already have it in the UK from what I'm reading, and now it's coming here. And I don't think You can say what you want. I don't think Trump is senile. The only people I see, sometimes I think we all have done this. I think you're making a mistake if you believe these, some of these stories. Sometimes you got to say, wait a minute, this is part of the, like what you think is objective news story is actually another bullshit bougie narrative, like that Trump's senile. You know, this is what they said when Biden, I mean, it's so glaring that these people wouldn't even admit. I noticed that Biden was kind of senile 3-4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, these people are so transparent. I mean, in the old days, we knew they were bad, but at least they pretended to be, you know, there was a certain civilized demeanor. There was certain organized, like with Nixon and Reagan and all these other bastards. It's just like the objective huge reality of society is much worse now. It's just like, because they've got nothing to lose. They're trying to hang on. The imperialist empire here isn't winning. They're just trying to hold on there onto the things that they won through active imperialism in the past. You know, these wars are not. Well, if they get what they want in Russia, that will be a new gain for them. But I don't think they're going to get what they want in Russia. But you know what I'm saying? Generally speaking, this country is falling apart before my eyes in ways that I never saw. I've known this for, I could have said this for a decade, but now it's like every time you think it can't get worse, another decade comes along and it's worse. I was walking around New York City the other day. I'm recovering from some surgery. I'm trying to get my shit together. So I finally took a walk out, you know, walking around. It was like every 10 feet, there's another homeless person coming at me. There's another homeless person. It's just like, And there's just so much. I can't even. It's like the barbarism is here. It's just a matter of them signing the final paper and say, okay, we've got fascism. That. And this is why I will actually defend an RFK on certain issues. I'm not saying he's with it. He's wrong on Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I could be wrong. These people might, but I kind of like hope that they win because the Democrats are just horrible. At least, I mean, you could just see, you just look at Kamala and listen to her talk. It's like this person is almost like, I don't want to sound like those people, those Israelis, but she doesn't seem human to me. Anyway, I'm just a little upset because it's just so scary what's going on. It's just so. People are getting arrested. There's cops. I mean, it's, you know, it's like a third world country on a lot of levels, you know, this dying empire of the United States here. So I just wanted to, you know, chime in with that. And also I think, you know, my take on the Spartacists is they disappeared. Then they came back. They were wrong about everything. I support the splits. The point is the splits. I know Bolshevik Tendency has the right line on Russia, but you can't find these people. You can't find them. You send them an email. Okay, I want to sit down and talk. You can't meet anybody. I don't know where they're hiding. You know, maybe they're in some other country.
Well, I think Rufus Vanguard was a fortnightly in the old days when I was a member of the Spartacist League. It's now produced three times a year or something like that.
Oh, yeah, but there was a period like before they sort of make a comeback in the last, I don't know, 2 or 3, 4, 5 years maybe. But if there was a period there in the teens or whatever, where it was like they barely existed.
That's true.
And now they seem to have like a new thing and they're admitting they were wrong. But they take the wrong line on I don't think it's a big deal that they're supporting PSL. I know some of these people I can find. There's very few forums to find any leftist to talk to. It's very fascistic in New York. I mean, I've been here for a while now, and I used to at least find some kind. It's like people, you're afraid to go to a demonstration. Or I should say, I'm afraid to go to a demonstration now. Maybe it's because I'm getting older, but it's also because there's a chill. What they did to these college students and these college presidents and all that, this is a big fucking deal. They're going after Scott Ritter. They're going after people who have voices. They don't all have to be our comrades, our Marxist comrades. These people are doing something with free speech. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I watch a lot of Jimmy Dore, Scott Ritter, and I, you know, the alternative media is the only place you can even get, you know, there's no good news anymore. Maybe it's better in the UK. Maybe you still have good outlets. I mean, I don't know where people get information. But, you know, I might move to Brazil for various reasons. And they don't have Rumble there. They don't have, they just block Twitter. I mean, you know, the United States, these people are trying to control the government arm of you know, the establishment. That's why they don't even like Trump. They say he's part of the establishment and he's an idiot and all that. But you might have noticed he's not acting the same crazy way he did when he was running in 16. He's learned a couple of things. He's learned to calm down, but I'm not saying he's a genius, but it's just, maybe I've changed. I don't know. I'm not saying it's much hope in any of these people, but the Democrats are leading us into a new, you know, just because of, basically, for me, the litmus test is how many people did they fucking kill in Ukraine, Russia, and Israel? Just the, and not to mention all the other places. But this is like, you know, I don't know.
Mark wants to speak, yeah?
I've got to go.
You've got to go, yeah?
Sorry.
Okay, we get
hey, John.
Yeah, we could. We, yeah, okay, John. We'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, I don't know why my camera doesn't work here. I don't know. I got a shitty computer.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking when I first went to New York, Trump, the election was on and every channel they were supporting and talking about Trump, literally every channel, not just Fox. And the stupidity in the bloke was so easy to see. To me, he's not anti-establishment. He's a multimillionaire. He pretends to be anti-establishment like Nigel Farage does in this country. By the way, this country's the worst I've ever seen it in all my years of being.
Yeah.
It's absolutely shocking and it's deteriorating into a right bloody mess. And the second time I went to New York, I saw more poor people on the streets, like you were just talking about, Max. And that was all related to Trump, but I think to a certain extent, you're right about Kamala Harris. She comes across as a bit of a robot. But to be honest, and I think the reason why she's probably getting a little bit more attention than Trump is because she knows when to keep her mouth shut. And Trump doesn't. Some of the comments he's made recently are absolutely... I was asked a few years ago, Jerry said to me, why don't you stand for United Union? And I said, no, I'm not smart enough to do that. But after I've bloody seen Donald Trump and Boris Johnson, I think I should have done. Because no matter how stupid I am, I could never be as stupid as Trump and Boris Johnson. Anyway, that's all I've got to say.
Just on the Sparts. The Sparts, I think, are not an American organisation anymore. I think their US group has disintegrated. It was big. It's gone. It's a small group. And what's happened is that the...
It's not even a shadow of its former self.
Yeah, I know.
It's not just, even that. That's what they were in the 90s. Now they're just like a recreation. I think they're spooks. I think they're like feds and secret agents and a lot of cops in there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
They're just remnants. There aren't many left in the United States. They are their leadership now is basically a bunch of Canadian Quebecois, Greeks... And the guy Vincent has moved to Britain who leads the SLB. I think he's Canadian Quebecois.
Yeah, I don't know the individuals, but the propaganda, their propaganda is nowhere near as good as it was even in the 80s and 90s when I knew that. I never joined them, but I was around them a lot when you were in that organization.
On one question, they've changed the position for the better, and that's the Middle East. There, if you read the New Spartacist, their article on the Middle East is very, very good. And they've changed
going
back to 1948. And it really is quite a remarkable change. And we're going to write something about this. I'm planning to. I think they're wrong on Ukraine. They're not as bad
totally
as the
IBT. Wrong.
They're not as bad as the IBT, who would say that Russia is imperialist. You know.
I thought they both said that.
No, the Sparts don't say that. They've got a funny...
But what do they say?
They say it's a... I don't know. They're incoherent, and I think they're...
They're incoherent.
I understand where they're coming from, but they're wrong. It's about their ultra-sensitivity on the national question. And
what does that mean?
Well, you have to read their article on the chauvinist.
No, but I mean, what is the term? What do you mean by the national question? What do you mean?
Their stuff about Quebec. their stuff about Belgium, their stuff about small nations.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Belgium. Well, even back at, when I was around them in the 80s and 90s, they would always have, like, one issue where I was thinking, I wasn't on the editorial board, but I, like I said, I read their paper, I hung around, I went to their meetings and stuff, but I never actually joined. I joined for like 5 minutes and then, you know, but I paid a lot of attention because that was my introduction to a lot of Trotskyism. Anyway, my point is, every once in a while they'd have some wacko, they'd always have like one or two issues, and I almost thought they were agent provocateurs in there making them do this. Like the thing with the man boy love association, remember that?
Well, that's ages old, though. That's really ages old. That goes back to the
70s. Yeah, but I'm saying I've noticed through the decade there's always been something weird about their propaganda. But I'm just going by the propaganda. The actual people I met.
Jim Robertson, you realize that? Jim Robertson could say and do what he liked, no matter how weird it was.
Well, that's what I heard. I heard about, but I never actually met those people. I just met whoever was running. You know what I mean? I heard about them, and there's all these conflicts and all this interpersonal bullshit. But that all smacks of like some, I don't know.
I understand where they got there. And this is we actually deal with a different group, completely different group, right? They come from Quebec. They do not come from. They're not Robertson anymore. Robertson's dead.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's like it's kind of like they went in the grave. They got buried and then they reemerged and maybe I don't know. I don't really know all the background, but you get a sense when you just read the propaganda and you go to a few meetings, you know, you get a sense, and then all this stuff about Robertson. But you know, I kind of knew by the '90s. Late 90s or early, no, more like the early aughts. When I came back to the United States, I was in Brazil. I started looking into the splits off the Spartacists. I thought, well, I always liked them, but there was something wrong with them. Now there's a split. And I was kind of doing this from the outside, but I read the propaganda. I'm a guy that, I'm an actual worker who reads the propaganda, whatever. And my point is, like, so I found out about the internationalist group, which I think are pretty good here in New York. At least you can find them. Like sometimes at a rally or I don't know if you know about Marty Goodman from the Socialist Action. I don't really support that group, but they have some good propaganda, and I met some of them, and they, you know, they're right on about half of the issues, but they're kind of like, you know, the BT types and the Sparty types. They're always accusing them of carrying the bags for you know, imperialism in Poland and all that stuff. It's kind of like, well, I think they're right, but it's like, why are you talking about? But there was a guy named Marty Goodman who was like the only comrade of Socialist Action here in New York City. And he'd go to every, and this guy was a tireless guy. He was a nice guy. Everybody loved him. So when I went to he died a few months ago. When I went to his memorial, I noticed, oh, even though on paper, they're accusing each other of not really being all this shit. We were trying to, the Trotskyists, they're always trying to prove to each other, oh no, I'm more of a Trotsky, that kind of shit. You know what I mean? I've been paying attention to this for years, and it drives me crazy.
They don't turn up.
It seems to stem from the intellectual people that are leading these organizations. But then it filters, trickles down to the, you know, I don't know. I think I've wasted a lot of time with that kind of shit. But it's real, and it's a problem. Anyway, I noticed that the guy, I forgot his name, the guy from Internationalist Group showed up at Marty Goodman's memorial. And so did a lot of people from the union movement and all kinds of people weren't like perfect. But, you know, it was a working class thing, and it was a good memorial. And the thing about him was everybody liked that guy because he was a good guy, even if he – you know, I sat there. He tried to recruit me, and I said, I don't know. I don't trust you on this, that, the other. But anyway, I don't know what my point was. Oh, anyway. My point was, Ian, you're one of the only people I've been able to really talk to or, you know, even just I get a sense we're on the same page mostly. And like I said, it's very isolating these days. It's very bad. So I sent you something in an email. Just to give you a sense of who I am and where I came from, I found something online from my father, who was a Deleonist, kind of Deleonist, Trotskyist, Leninist, whatever. So you can get a sense of what my foundations were and how I started thinking about this stuff back in the 70s because of my father's, you know, and his group called Socialist Forum, which was a small propaganda group. The fact that I found something online was like, otherwise it's like so many of these, it makes you realize there's so many attempts at forming revolutionary organizations that never even make, that we don't know about. We got to keep that in mind when we get, or I keep it in mind. It's like, you know, when I get discouraged, you think it's hopeless, we're going to lose, we want to kill ourselves, whatever. You know, for every Malcolm X and this group and that group and the ones we know about, there's a hundred other ones. There's people trying to, you know, there's always another group that we didn't hear about, is what I'm saying. Because if my father came from that, then that's probably happening all over the world. You know what I mean? It's like the part of history that never gets into the book, you know? We have to always remember that, you know? Like, it's not just about, oh, Trotsky, Lenin, and the leaders. It's not just about the leadership. It's about the, you know, the masses. Like, I read somewhere once that, you know, during the Stalinist purges in the late 20s or 30s, over 10 or 20,000 real socialists, just regular worker, you know, regular comrades who weren't big shots or whatever, but were part of the thing, who Stalin, you know, but they were on the opposition with Trotsky, you know, leaning toward Trotsky, killed themselves. There were over like 20,000 suicides. That's how bad. So anytime people tell me, well, Stalin wasn't that bad. Yes, he was. He drove these people. That's what the betrayal really meant. Mm-hmm. Not just, you know, or the books by Trotsky, but what it really meant, you know. I don't remember where I read that, but that's the kind of thing that I think about that doesn't get talked about. Yeah, we're splitting hairs. I don't want to go on and on and on, but you know what I'm saying. We got to always remember that there's something more. There's something more to basic, like, oh, we've got the numbers. We got to remember that. It's easy to say, but I don't know. We're living in a very dark time right now. I mean, I feel like the fucking iron heel is going to come down. I mean, people getting arrested, coming to that. People, like, they went after Tulsi Gabbard. I know Tulsi Gabbard's not the big hero, but it's not. She's not Hitler. I mean, they're trying to say that people that defend, like, RFK, these people, well, they didn't go after RFK. They did keep him from being able to run, though. So this, you know, you can say, yeah, they're all establishment, they're all ruling clique, but they're fighting amongst themselves right now, and we should realize that and figure out which
because we are getting, it's getting very late here.
Yeah, I know. I came in late. I forgot about it until. All right, sorry.
We should wind it up and reconvene in 2 weeks. I'm not sure. I think we need to think about a topical forum. Like, we agreed to alternate these. So I'll talk to comrades on Tuesday and we can decide what to do for the next one. Yeah, if that's
we should talk about Daniel DeLeon sometime.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Yeah.
That's where a lot of my ideas come from and my attitude about, like, you know,
syndicalism. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Well, that's what they say.
What do you? Can I switch this recording off actually? Because it's been running.
All right, turn it off.